Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a little bit about the workings of Comintern in the interwar period. Comintern, the international organization established after the Russian Revolution, after the Bolshevik seizure of power, initially meant to be the next iteration of the Communist International, as the First and Second Internationals had existed across Europe before the revolution. This was the supposedly the organization of the Third International. It attracted communists from around the world, from Western Europe, from Asia and America and beyond. But it was under in the mid to late 1920s, and then during the 1930s, it has an entirely different purpose. It is a means of controlling communist parties in non-communist countries. So every communist party in Europe is answerable to Comintern and expected to take the Comintern line. Dissenting communist parties across Europe feel the pressure of loyalists and of illegals, the Soviet agents in embassies abroad, breathing down their necks. And there were some who met with violence and some who were even murdered for the crime of dissenting attitudes towards Stalinism. And during the 1930s, of course, the question of Spain is what Comintern is galvanized around finding international volunteers for. The international brigades are the creation of Comintern. So, here we're looking at Anne Applebaum's excellent book, Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe. And previously, we'd looked at Matthias Rakosi, Walter Ulbricht, and Boleslaw Bierut, the three leaders of Communist Hungary, East Germany, and Poland, respectively. And the three of them were deeply were deeply connected to Comintern during the interwar period, and this is a reason why they were so successful in their careers after the war. These were the kinds of communists that the Soviets rather liked, and they were less enamoured with those from Western countries. Okay. So, as Anne Applebaum writes, she says, "As their biographies reveal, these three men did share certain things. All of them had worked closely with Comintern. All of them had survived the war either by fleeing to Moscow or by obtaining Moscow's help. In shorthand that later became popular, all of them were Moscow communists, that is, Soviet-trained communists, as opposed to communists who'd made their careers in their own countries, or communists who'd spent the war in Western Europe or North America. From the Soviet point of view, the latter two groups were less reliable. They might well have acquired suspicious views or dubious contacts in their years spent outside the USSR. So, this term, Moscow communists, is symptomatic of the kind of paranoid state of the kind of Stalinist regime, of even those who profess to be communists, the extent to which they were Stalinists and not Trotskyites, the extent to which they were not somehow revisionists and pursuing a softer social democratic line, the extent to which they had been compromised by Western security services already, was unknown to Stalin, and he was very, very cautious about these kinds of individuals. In some ways, they were more dangerous than the enemies that present themselves with tanks and aircraft on your borders, because they're the people who can get within. They're the ones that can spread seditious ideas within and cause all sorts of trouble. Moscow communists would play a significant role in the creation of all the post-war governments across Eastern Europe. Clement Gottwald, the Czechoslovak Little Stalin, for example, had been a Comintern leader, as had Joseph Tito, the partisan leader who became the Yugoslav dictator, Georgi Dimitrov, Bulgaria's Little Stalin, who was the leader of Comintern for almost a decade, and he was put on trial by the Nazis following the Reichstag fire. But this didn't just contain itself to Eastern Europe. Maurice Thorez, the leader of the French Communist Party during and after the war, and Palmiro Togliatti, who had the same position in the Italian Communist Party, were also Moscow communists. Both these figures were intimately connected in Comintern affairs, and this is why in 1946-47, the Communist parties in Italy and in France were of huge anxiety to America and to the growing intelligence operation in America, that was fearful that unless something was done, that Western Europe would start to slide towards communism as well. So there was every possibility, though the chance never presented itself, that the two men would have wanted to seize power in Western Europe. In a way, the devastation of Eastern Europe by Hitler, and then by Stalin as well, created the conditions for Stalinism in those countries. Devastation in France and in Italy, while significant, in terms of lives lost and infrastructure destroyed, is in no way near comparable to that which was experienced by countries such as Poland. And the fact that the Red Army presence on the soil of those countries in 1945 dictated all other facts. There were a couple of exceptions across Eastern Europe. The post-war communist government in Romania, run by Gheorghiu Dej, was run by a non-Moscow communist, a local. But this meant that, in many ways, the levels of kind of obsequiousness and the levels of kind of bending the knee to Moscow went far further in Romania than they might have done actually in somewhere like Czechoslovakia or East Germany. The names and the faces of these little Stalins would slowly appear all across their home countries. But what tended to happen is that the better-known figures like Ulbricht or Gottwald were then supplemented by other Moscow communists, so the Czech or German Moscow communists, who were there to ensure ideological purity, who were there to report on the new leaders of newly Stalinized countries back to Moscow, and also were there to fulfill the role of potential successor in waiting should one leader not work out. So there were entire generations of Moscow communists populating every tier of government. Anne Applebaum writes, Boleslav Bierut's two most important psychics, Jakob Behrmann and Hilary Minch, the former in charge of ideology and propaganda, and the latter in control of the economy, would eventually line up with him against Warsaw or home communists such as Gomulka. In Hungary, Rakosi also headed a troika of Moscow communists. The other two members were Józef Rivai and Erno Gero, again in charge of ideology and economics, respectively. Mihály Farkas, Minister of Defence between 1948 and 53, was another important sidekick. All of them would eventually turn against the Budapest communists too. In Germany, Ulbricht's most important colleague, Wilhelm Pick, who had a long Comintern history, having been General Secretary of the organisation from 1938 to 43. From the very earliest days of Soviet occupation, all of the German communists who returned to Berlin early, on planes flown directly from Moscow, or in the company of Red Army troops, all had higher status than those German communists who found refuge in France, where many were harassed by French authorities, Morocco, where they lurked in the background of the film Casablanca, Sweden, where Bertolt Brecht lived for a while, Mexico, then very friendly to communists, and the United States. The Soviet leadership even considered them more trustworthy than the German communists who'd stayed in Germany to fight the Nazis. Now, here is one of the great and cruel ironies of Stalinism, that only the bureaucrats who had, for the most part, avoided any as much danger as possible during the war by hiding out in Moscow, only they were considered to be the worthwhile leaders of the new Stalinist states to be established across Eastern Europe. Those that had properly got their hands dirty, and from France to Greece, from the Low Countries to Poland, there were communist partisans who, and obviously deep into Russia, there were.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Communist partisans, whose efforts were significant in grinding down the Nazi war machine. I think there was a study done a couple of years ago that suggested that the French communists took more of the risks, more of the casualties, and had more of the successes than the Gaullists in the resistance could really claim. But it was these homegrown communist partisans were the ones who are kind of thrown under the bus first. And when they object to the return of Moscow communists who have their own agendas, then they face some pretty unpleasant circumstances. The communists who had suffered at the hands of the Nazis, those who had been political prisoners in the concentration camps, they actually, instead of being seen as martyrs to the cause, were treated with immense suspicion by the Soviets. The first question the Soviets asked is, how did you survive? What did you do in the camps when so many other communists died? How did you survive? Who did you make deals with? Who did you compromise with? Who did you betray? And the fear was that the communists in the camps that might have been turned by the Nazis would then be recruited by the Western powers and be dangerous subversives. The existence of those who had been prisoners of the Nazis was very, very, in communist propagandist terms, this was a real problem. Now, there's a separate issue of Soviet soldiers taken prisoner by the Nazis and their fate when they return to the Soviet Union, which is a pretty bleak. But we'll attend to that another time. So, throughout Eastern Europe, the Moscow communists were united not just by a common ideology, but also by a common commitment to Comintern's overall goal of worldwide revolution. The idea that worldwide revolution seemed very achievable in 1945, so achievable that it had the Western capitalist powers highly alarmed. Knowing what we know now with hindsight, we can see perhaps the impossibility of this, or the naivety of it, or whatever. But being no doubt, it's a great many people like Ulbricht or Gomulka or Beirut saw these things as not just historical realities, but historical inevitabilities. If you read the tea leaves of Marx as kind of historical dialectic, then revolution was just going to come. The declaration that Stalin had of socialism in one country during the 1930s had kind of ended the tension between the Soviet Union and the Western powers. The Soviet Union, up until that point, had been seen as an expansionist force, a force of constant subversion, something that was spreading revolution and frightening capitalist governments around the world. However, even when Stalin declared that the goal was to defend the revolution within one country, to build up socialism there, to build factories and war industries and a vast arsenal to defend the country, even then, it obviously didn't deter Stalin from using his secret services, and also from using Comintern to spread as much subterfuge across Europe as possible. They were simply another means of advancing warfare against the West instead of the Red Army. As we know, the biggest intelligence coup that the Soviets had were the Cambridge spy ring, and Guy Burgess, Kim Philby, Donald MacLean, Anthony Blunt. There were other intelligence operatives who were recruited at GCHQ, John Cairncross, who later worked on Bletchley Park during the war. John Cairncross himself was not one of the kind of member of the Cambridge Circle. He was, by his own admission, posthumous admission, a working class socialist who had decided voluntarily to help the Soviet Union. He wasn't so much recruited as volunteered. In America, there were obviously the likes of Alger Hiss, Harry Dexter White, and Whittaker Chambers. And here we've got this kind of division between East and West. We have the Western spies and double agents who were feeding information to Comintern. And then in the East, you have people who, like Walter Ulbricht, who are explicitly openly communist, who have been part of condemned communist parties across Europe and have fled to Moscow and done Moscow's bidding quite openly. One of the things about the British spies is that they were encouraged to, as quickly as possible, repudiate the Communist Party. But there is a connection between them. They were all willing to work closely with Soviet intelligence. And for a while, most European communists considered either that so working close to Soviet intelligence, should they have had the opportunity, would be perfectly morally acceptable and perfectly okay. Or some who were recruited were happy to kind of go along with this. The degree of orthodoxy is in large part to do with the crushing of Trotskyism and other kind of schisms and other kind of sectarian communist parties across Europe. And the degree of conformity is also a kind of a key feature of Stalinism. It's only after 1956 and the Budapest uprising that really the world of European communism begins to fragment and fall apart, and you have people leaving European communist parties in vast numbers. So Anne Applebaum writes, through their links to Soviet secret police, though their links to Soviet secret police are now felt in retrospect to have tarnished American and European communist parties, it did not bother the leaders of those parties at the time. Generally speaking, those in the West who believed in the desirability of world revolution also thought that this revolution would be led by the Soviet Communist Party and thus facilitated by the Soviet secret police. Even the American Communist Party took money from the USSR, sometimes channeled through Comintern. Many left-wing intellectuals at the time knowingly met NKVD agents on a regular basis as a matter of course. There was no stigma, as there would be in later years, in taking Moscow gold or in doing a few favours for the local undercover agents of the NKVD or, as it was later known, the KGB. To the truly dedicated, the goals of the USSR, of the Comintern, of the USSR's spies, and of their own national communist parties would have seemed utterly interchangeable. And there, I mean, the fascinating thing about Comintern is that you start to find the makings of this strange kind of transnational political kind of polity, if you will, across Europe, where communist parties and communist activists look to Moscow. They see solidarity with other communist parties in places like Spain. They view themselves as having very little to do with the society that they're existing in, that they essentially wish to overthrow. And they are often highly immersed in these kind of quite obscurantist debates happening at the heart of Stalin's Russia. They adopted the Leninist model of hierarchical party organization, this sort of notion of this kind of contradictory notion of democratic centralism. They developed general secretaries and politburos, commissars. They referred to one another as obviously as comrades, and they began to develop the same kind of level of anti-democratic bureaucratism that the Soviet Union saw as well. For each of the parties of Western Europe, and Eastern Europe as well, the opportunity of a visit to the Soviet Union was present, particularly for a certain given small number of party officials. Those who were considered to be rising stars within their movement were invited to and allowed to study at the Lenin School in Moscow. This was really a school for training Comintern agents, and there were Comintern agents across Europe who were engaged in doing the bidding of the organisation in the interwar years. So we'll finish there, but there is a fascinating relationship between the development of Comintern in the interwar years and what its alumni therefore do in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. Anyway, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you, all the best, bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.